Hello there and welcome to the second Queensland Gardening Hour podcast. Yay, we made it to two. This morning we have with us Jerry Colby-Williams.
Good morning.
And Noel Burdett.
Good morning.
And my name's LJ Stockwell. Now, boys, I thought we'd start out by saying what's been happening in your garden.
There's been a lot happening in my garden.
Yeah, do tell.
But I haven't been around.
You have got staff.
I had my housemate Damo. He took responsibility for looking after the place for 3 weeks while I was overseas. And
I've met Damo. Damo and I spent some time together selling jams at Jerry's Open Day.
That's right, you did, yeah. Didn't you? Yeah,
lovely chap.
So the garden survived. The garden's grown, and I'm doing an awful lot of weeding.
Weeds at this time of year.
Yeah, look, we just change shifts. We go from warm season weeds to cool season weeds. I mean, there's no change. It's a very good season for growing pretty much anything.
It's funny though that you say that about the weeds, because I look forward to the winter weeds because they actually feed my chooks.
Ah,
and they're
right.
Incredibly nutritious. All the winter grass, all the little spurges that come up, all the rumex that comes up, yeah. And all the chickweed. They love it. So I go off virtually every morning and go and pick a bucket load and give it to my girls.
I do give some to my guinea pigs,
yeah.
But mostly it goes into the compost heap, and I try and cheer myself up by saying, well, that's a good compost activator.
Yeah, that's true. Mind you, that's about the happiest I do get about weeds.
Yeah.
I don't often look forward to them as much, but during the cooler weather, it's when they become very, very nutritious for my girls.
Are they a bit more sturdy?
The weeds.
The winter weeds.
Oh, yes, because they hold on to that morning dew, and like the other morning, they got a light frost on them, so they were quite crispy.
Nice. You could almost cook them. Do a quick stir fry with your winter weeds.
Well, I might actually bring you in something with chickweed, because that's actually really tasty.
Is it?
Yes.
And what's been happening in your garden, Noel?
Well, my garden's taken on a winter coat, and that's really quite something I look forward to each year with my bulbs popping out of the ground and my veggie garden, you know, coming along the way it is, because I like to grow a lot of my veggies during the cooler weather anyway.
So what have you got in your veggie garden?
I have English spinach. I have something new that I've got growing for the first time, which is a red-veined sorrel. I brought a sample in to show you. I love sorrel. And, of course, I've got celery, which is really good for you, lots of parsley and
ask for some celery growing tips while you're there?
Mm.
Do you put milk cartons around them to make them white?
No, I don't. I don't need to blanch them. I grow my celery quite naturally. I find by growing them naturally, they actually get a higher level of salinity within them, and they get higher nutrition because they can... they get greener in the stem, so they have a higher level of chlorophyll, which means they're actually better for you. So the blanched celery that you find in the shops are grown so heavily productive, they pump them full of water and they blanch them to grow like that. It's tasty, but not as good for you as homegrown celery.
Interesting.
It's interesting you talking about blanching celery, because I thought you were a modern woman. And a lot of the old-fashioned varieties of celery had to be blanched. But nowadays, I mean, from the 70s, I remember self-blanching celery, which basically meant it wasn't as bitter.
Mm.
So you didn't need to exclude the sunlight to bleach the stalks to get the mild flavour. And I remember I was the one that accepted it. My granddad didn't like it.
He was an old-fashioned...
He liked to blanch.
Oh,
yeah,
he did.
Just like you say, yeah, he wanted to blanch them. I broke away, being modern.
It was the 70s,
done.
I reckon.
Well done. I actually prefer the flavour of naturally grown celery that's unblanched anyway.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic salt substitute in your diet.
Oh, okay.
Natural.
And so do you walk out of a night and look around at what's in the garden and just think, okay, we're going to have a stir fry with celery, or we're going to have, you know, do you cook by what you see ready to pick?
I actually add from the garden into the dishes that we make. I have a partner at home that likes to have different meals every night.
Oh,
so
gosh.
So as such...
High maintenance.
Yeah. So as such, we add from that vegetable garden. So I don't use it as a basis. I add from there. So that's how I utilise the veggies. And it's been interesting because this year I've had my first... major bumper crop of three fruit off my Hicks and Mandarin, which I saved from death about a year and a half ago. So I'm a bit excited about that.
Three fruit.
Woo-hoo. Oh, I'm over the moon. Absolutely over the moon. But you know what? It was such a dying little plant when I brought it home, and I took pity on it because I love Hicks and Mandarins.
Now, boys, we should move on to questions, because I did ask a friend for some feedback and she said people love to have their questions answered. So let's start with the first Ask It, Solve It.
Okay, well, the first question I've got comes from Barry, who asks, apart from sowing radishes now, because now is a great time for sowing winter vegetables like radishes, what else should we plant in a small urban yard with limited sun? And that's the most important thing, because most crops need 6 hours of sunlight a day to grow well. And that's important in winter because the days are shorter, the sun is weaker. So that 6 hours is really the least that you need to grow most things. So what I said is basically you need to organise a checklist, keep a note, familiarise yourself with my monthly posts on my website, which is www.jerry-colby-williams, because I do a month-by-month account of what's in production in my garden. But right now, if you want to get outside and plant something, you can plant strawberry, asparagus, Jerusalem artichoke, deciduous fruit trees while they're dormant, best time to plant them, things like mulberry and avocado. You can sow dwarf French beans, broccoli, carrots. I like the stump-rooted carrots. Peas, cabbage and kale, and of course salad vegetables, which is what I started gardening growing. We've already mentioned radishes, spring onions and lettuce. That's heaps to get a garden going.
That's a huge selection. If you can't find something in there that you don't like, you know, I think you should maybe give up gardening and go and selling clothes instead.
But you could probably grow some of those things in boxes.
Absolutely.
Or pots as well, so
Absolutely.
You don't need acres
in
to
fact,
grow
I've
them.
Seen many of those grown in boxes on verandas and patios and balconies, Jerry. So it's a very good point that you bring up there. People can grow all those things brilliantly.
So that's a fantastic list, and if you didn't catch all of that, we'll post it on our website, which is Queensland Gardening Hour, and look out for Jerry's winter veggie notes. All right, Noel, what have you got a question from anyone?
Well, yes, there's an interesting question that came through to me actually on my Facebook page, which is Noel Burdett Growing Gardeners, and from Margaret at Stafford, and she said, hi, Noel, I hope you're well. I have a question regarding passion fruit tendrils. Are they edible? Mine have twisted themselves all over my curry leaves, which I like to give away to customers. Just concerned if I miss picking any of them from the leaves. I Googled the question, but I could not find an answer. Now, it's a funny little thing, because I've never known passion fruit tendrils to be edible in any form, shape, whatever. Well, I don't know about you, Jerry, but it's not something that I would be concerned about, though, if it did happen to make their way into a curry, like from the curry leaves. But they're not an edible part of the plant.
I've heard no ill said about them.
No.
The only thing I've learnt about passion fruit was when I was away just recently, and Passiflora fetida, which is a weed, is eaten as a vegetable in Vietnam.
Yes, it's interesting.
So, look, you can't say just because one species is okay that all the others aren't.
True.
Because that can't apply. But I've never heard anything about them being toxic.
No, I've not even heard anyone saying that they are edible. So let's, you know.
Well, wouldn't you err on the side of caution?
I think you would.
Yeah.
Yes.
Don't eat the passion fruit tendrils.
the thing with anything like that is that there is the internet. And you can go onto the internet to find out information about medicinal uses for plants, and that's often the way that you can find your way in. And then you'll find a reference saying that there are precautions if you take other medicines when you're taking this. And that's often how I pick up on those little threads.
That's very true, because a lot of these plants that we take for granted or see as edible may have actually alkaloids within them that could counteract any medications that people are taking quite naturally. Uh-huh. So this is the reason why. So I agree with you. People need to look into it. The internet is an amazing world for people to get information, but at the same time, it's quite a dangerous world out there for people to get the wrong information or to misinterpret the information that's out there.
Yeah.
It's brilliant for information, not so good for instant wisdom.
That's true.
Yeah. Now, Jerry, tell us a little bit about Vietnam, because I know you've been away for a couple of weeks leading a tour of garden enthusiasts through Vietnam. What did you see over there?
Well, we wanted to see as many different things as we could that weren't on an itinerary for ordinary travellers. So the highlight, I guess, was we went from Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, right the way up to Hanoi, and stopped at Hue on the way. So it was three city bases. Everywhere is tropical, and it was really hot while we were there. So it was 34 to 36 degrees. So the ladies that came with me, we were at the limit of our physical ability to do things.
Hang on, sorry for being ignorant. Drying out. 34 degrees. Now, Vietnam is in the northern hemisphere, isn't it? So it's their winter.
It's actually
closer to the equator.
It's actually their summer.
Oh.
Yeah, it's on the northern hemisphere, so it's their summer. Yes. So we were there in the low season for tourists, but it was at its hottest.
Oof.
So there was an awful lot of drinking to get through the days. I think the biggest thing was most people there that are in grow food or medicinal plants for themselves or for profit. They have a personal allocation of 300 square metres of soil from the government. So that's like an allotment sort of a system.
That's wonderful.
So if you want to grow food, that's what you get, 300 square metres per person.
And everyone can have that?
Yeah, everybody's entitled
to it.
They
don't pay for that.
Well, again, it varies a lot. We went to one commune, and that was an eye-opener because they get 6 holidays a year. Otherwise, they work 7 days a week from dawn till dusk. Cool. They live on site, and they're extraordinarily happy. You know, it's a weird thing where family replaces services that we would expect the government to provide in Australia, because there is no pension, there's no holidays, there's no paid sick leave. When you see gardens there, most of them are not ornamental, they're productive. And the thing that really hit me, that really has still got me buzzing, was the emphasis on medicinal plants in their food. So their food is their medicine.
Yep.
And a lot of the sort of microscopic travelling that I did was unwrapping food parcels and trying to identify what it was I was eating, because they couldn't explain to me at a restaurant what it was in the food.
That's interesting. You know that Vietnamese chef, Luke?
Yes, Nguyen.
He makes that point all the time, that your food is your medicine.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. That's a really old saying, you know, medicine is your food and the food is your medicine.
Yeah.
And that's obviously inbuilt and institched into that culture, at all those cultures in the whole area, I'd say. And this is quite commonly seen. I've seen this pop up many, many times in a lot of different cultures.
So lots of green leaves?
Yes, yeah. a lot of fresh food.
Yes.
It's not as spicy as Thai food, but they have an enormous amount of stocks and broths and soups that go with their food.
Beautiful.
So it's very light. They do have quite a range of meat. I mean, they're omnivores, and they eat a wider range of meat than we would eat, but you don't eat as much. Mm. So it's more like a seasoning. And I enjoyed that. That was a nice variation. I had no preconceptions about Vietnam. So I just dived in and just made the best of it.
But how healthy is that? Like some nice broth with a little bit of protein and lots of green veggies in it. You know, that is like the best food you could possibly
Incredibly
eat.
Incredibly aromatic and refreshing.
Beautiful. And now, Noel, you haven't been as far afield, but I know that this weekend you were at the Laidley Show. So
yes.
What happened out there?
Well, I love country shows, and there's something so warm and fuzzy about being at a country show and knowing that a lot of country hospitality is around you. So it was great to see all the cows and all the... I love Brahman cows, by the way. Just need to let you know that.
Yeah.
And, of course, all the chooks, the fresh produce, which I was pretty much blown away by for people that were growing things in that entire district, because it gets mighty cold. The other morning that we had at my place, which was 0.1 degrees in the morning, it was, I think, -4 out there. So they had a very, very crisp and brisk start to the day. And, people are showcasing things such as their beautiful Jerusalem artichokes and their turmerics and their galangals and their gingers that they're growing out in that district.
Beautiful.
It's quite interesting to see how – it's surprising to see that they're growing a lot of tropical spices and things in those areas. I think we often see the Lockyer Valley area as somewhere just where you'd expect to see cabbages.
And carrots, beans.
And, yes, and you do see cabbages and things by – and my gosh, there were cabbages this big,
about
a metre wide.
A metre and a half.
Unbelievable. You know, they were the actual head was the actual much, much bigger than my head.
Hey, there's another story. We must cover gigantic vegetables one day. Yeah. I know Jerry's got an interest in that. Didn't you have a relative that was interested in gigantic vegetables?
No. Oh, I think you're thinking of somebody else. Yeah. I've grown some threateningly large beans. Yeah. And yes, they could get me arrested if I was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
And it was nice to see. Unfortunately, the people who put these vegetables and fruits into the competitions, they weren't around for me to actually chat to.
Isn't that annoying?
No, they enter, they place their produce on show, and yet they're not around to talk about it. They were a bit shy.
They let their veggies do the talking
for
them.
They're a little bit shy. And, of course, the horticultural pavilion, which also included all your cut flowers and your potted plants, which is just lovely, and of course the floral art section.
Oh yeah, beautiful.
So I was invited to be the judge of the horticultural section. I wasn't judging the produce, but all the other things, as well as Di McRae, our friend Di, and it was just a lovely event to be at because the hospitality was lovely. The food, oh my gosh, to see all these amazing cakes made by the CWA.
This was
real food, honestly, and I can't eat any of it, but it was just so incredibly tempting, and thank heavens, is all I have to say, thank heavens, it was under glass.
Yeah, because you just would have launched yourself at it.
But more than anything, I was blown away by the artistic quality of this food and how much time that people took to make sure their pikelets were exactly circular. You know, I personally couldn't care less how it's like the pikelet looks on the edge.
Whack a bit of jam on
it. But these people, and they take it very seriously with the judging, incredibly seriously. The judges don't want to be talked at, don't want to be talked to at all. And you just sit there and taste, all in silence while everyone watches them. I found that fascinating in itself and just a little bit funny, I must admit. The floral art was a lot of fun because, of course, my background's floristry, so I appreciated that and the artistic talents of a lot of the people. There were men and ladies that actually, you know, came on board. And, you know, it's not just people in Laidley. Shows like this, agricultural shows like this, bring people together from all other districts. So there are people that came from Toowoomba, as far away as Bow Desert. They all partake in these country agricultural shows. That's what I love about them. It's just such a fun atmosphere.
Noel, did you get any questions while you were there?
Oh, yes. I did a bit of a horticultural talk as well.
What have you got?
Well, I didn't get any questions as such. Mm-hmm. Questions about how that person grew 6 spikes of Eucharist lilies in 1 plant. I had no answer to that because I found that a triumph in itself. I have never seen that before.
Mm.
I've only been able to get at the very most 2 in 1 pot, and yet this lady had 6 in the 1 pot. It was incredible to see. And Eucharist lilies are also known as the Amazon lily, and they've got beautiful daffodil-like white flowers on them. So there are questions such as, you know, how do you get the fern to wrap around the side of the basket? Those sorts of things. And I'll try to explain, well, that's its natural habitat. You know, that's what it does. Its natural habit is to cling onto the side of organic material, such as trees or rocks or boughs or branches and things like that. So this is how they naturally grow. So somebody actually thought that was trained.
But
those sort of things were quite simple. So, and it's nice. The cut flowers, for instance, some people have never seen the many different colours of phlox, you know, or they hadn't seen phlox since they were a child. So it brought back a lot of memories. Mm. So it's a nice way of creating, you know, conversation as well. And I'd like to see more of the agricultural shows supported by a lot of
those
people.
Sort of thing. Yeah. Boggy does. Brisbane Organic Growers Incorporated has a wonderful show in spring.
They do have a show. And, of course, people from the city should always make the attempt to go, not just the Yekka in the city of Brisbane. Mm. That's a lot of fun too, of course. But the little ones out in the outskirts, you know, that's where they should go to visit as well, to get a real taste of the country atmosphere.
All right, boys, let's move on to another question. Have you got one then, Jerry?
Yes, look, I got this one through Facebook, and it was from Janet, and she wanted me to give her seed of Ethiopian cabbage, which is a species, Brassica carinata, and it has a loose leaf. It looks like a wild cabbage because it is a species. It doesn't form a head, but it grows about 2.5 metres high. and it has a waxy coating on the leaf, which means that when caterpillars feed on it, they never make it to adulthood. It gives them terminal indigestion. And in fact, if you eat the leaves raw in coleslaw, you will get indigestion as well. So you always cook it. And that's the way to enjoy it. And as a leafy green, it is absolutely delicious. And I like growing it because it is so spectacular. Once they're full of bees, the flower heads will be a metre high and almost a metre across. It's a massive yellow flower.
Can you tell us the name again?
Brassica carinata, or Ethiopian cabbage. And the variety I grow is called Old Women Meat and Gossip. And that's politically correct, but it's an unusual vegetable. It's difficult to get hold of the seed, and she wanted to get seed. And she asked me just before I went overseas, and she reminded me about it. So what I advised her to do is to join the Seed Savers Network, which you can find online. We've got, I'm a director of Seed Savers, so I must declare that I have an interest in them. It's a charity. We have 100 local groups around Australia. You pay an annual membership fee to become a seed saver, and then you have access to all of our seed for free. So it's
and what
it's a
does
very
everyone contribute their seed? Is that how you do it?
We locally pool. So each local group. So we've got a group just north of Brisbane, and there's the Redlands Organic Growers, Roggy. They are another seed saver network. So you can actually ask each of the networks whether they've got these seed, and we exchange seed for free.
Beautiful.
So that's the way she can get hold of
those. Hey, I've got to tell you, I've got a question too, and I know you boys hate all the endless citrus questions, but we are going to do that in this show.
They're a fact of life.
They are a fact of life, and I've got the worst scale on my citrus and black soot, so we need to get to that fairly soon, okay? Let's take a break. It's that time of the show where we get to have something yummy, which is really good. I just whipped upstairs and heated up Jerry's soup that he's made for us this morning. It's called coco yam soup. Jerry, do tell.
Well, coco yam is one of those plants that I grow a lot of as an alternative source of starch. It's an elephant ear type of plant. Xanthosoma sagittifolia is the scientific name. It grows about 2 metres high and about 2 metres across. You get a stalk, a stem, which is probably as big as your forearm, and that's what you're eating now, peeled, boiled, and then blended with water, coconut milk. There's a stock cube, chili, garlic and onion. And I think I put some black pepper in because the chili was homegrown and it wasn't as hot as I really wanted. So I like it to have a little bit of a bite. This is a winter warming soup. You can get starch from the roots as well, and they form what are called cormlets. And this is a cormlet. And the difference between the cormlet and the stems is that the stems take about 15 minutes to soften, so a bit like potato, whereas the cormlets, you just scrub them like a new potato, and in 5 minutes, these are as soft as butter. Now, if you grow these plants in the South Pacific, a lot of islanders would not use the stem starch to make soup. They would feed that to their pigs. But I find it's such a good quality that I eat that as well as these cormlets. And the cormlets are the gourmet's food. The young leaves can be cooked, chopped up and cooked like spinach, but you've got to cook them for about 10 to 15 minutes because they contain crystals which will burn your mouth if you don't cook them first. And so that's three things that you can get from one plant.
But this won't kill me.
This won't kill you. In fact,
nutritional value?
It's a starch, so it's a low GI starch, so you get a sustained release of energy from it. Mm. The most important thing about this as a food is that it's very digestible. So people that are recovering from long-term illness, people with celiac disease and infants, servants really benefit from using cocoa yam starch as a mashed potato, as something which is baked or pureed and cooked
diabetic?
In soup. It's good for diabetics.
Slow GI,
as well.
That's
yeah,
good.
Yeah, it's very good.
And it's yummy. I love how you've put some coconut milk through, so it's creamy. It's got a little bit of saltiness, a bit of chili. I can taste that. Jerry, it's delicious.
Well, this is what I would normally serve with a crusty roll and some butter as an evening soup.
And there's a herb in there, isn't there?
That's Chinese celery. Mm. Earlier, Noel was talking about using celery as a natural form of salt. Chinese celery is a very small thing, only grows a couple of feet high, 60 centimetres high, very thin stems, about the thickness of a pencil, but it's got a strong celery flavour, so I use it as a herb rather than a vegetable.
Super yummy.
Very and delicious, I have
Noel,
to say.
What about your...
I love all soups.
All soups, yeah, that's really good, isn't it? What is in Noel's drawers?
Well, I thought I'd bring an interesting plant. I mentioned it earlier today, actually.
Oh, yeah?
And it's a new sorrel. Well, it's not new, actually. It's an old sorrel, but it's newly available on the market. And it's a rumex, so it's not the traditional type of sorrel that you would grow. And I quite like sorrel. It has a lovely slight bitterness.
That looks sort of like a tiny little beetroot leaf.
It does a little bit, but it's very pretty. As these leaves develop, they get these in beautiful deep burgundy veins. It becomes stronger and stronger to look at. And, of course, as the plant gets older, the leaves also become a lot more stronger in their flavour. Really nice for adding thickeners to soups. You can add it to any sort of soup, but it adds a really nice flavour. It's not bitter. It's not untasty bitter. It's just pleasant bitterness, and I think that's a really nice thing. You can cut the leaves while they're young and throw them into salads. Mm-hmm. And I've thrown them into the... I've grown this in the vegetable garden this year just for something new to encourage the other half to eat something a little bit different. I haven't really said what it was. I'm just going to present it.
Don't say anything.
No.
Just put it on a plate.
Absolutely right, because it looks lovely.
Num num.
But the third thing is, you know, at the end of the growing season, because these actually last, they're actually a short-lived perennial, so they'll actually be there for a much longer period of time. They're not seen as an annual. So at the end of the growing season in the summertime, what they'll do is they will send off these soft little spikes like most rumexes do, which for me is a wonderful thing because it also helps to bring more pollinating and beneficial insects to the garden. So it has another use. Mm-hmm. And that's another reason why I've popped it in the garden this year. And I've got this mixed planted in with some flowering plants, actually, things such as sunflowers and linseed and calendulas and all those sorts of things. So they'll look attractive, but it'll be edible and functional at the same time. So something just a bit different.
Yeah, nice.
Now, yeah, and something else now, back onto the flowering thing. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned earlier about my bulbs coming up. So I brought you a little sample of one of my jonquils.
Oh, that's
to
beautiful.
To have a smell.
Yeah.
And jonquils would have to be my favourite perfume for the wintertime. It always reminds me of my childhood.
I can smell it from here.
Yeah,
it's
lovely.
Sweet, isn't
yeah,
it?
And Jerry would be, you know, obviously that would remind him as well of England a lot of the time. And growing up in Victoria, that's what I would see growing in the gardens and growing in the paddocks, you know, or the older gardens, the neglected gardens, that's where you'll find them. Mm. Now, I have a succession of different types of jonquils, and they start flowering from around late June, mid-June for me, and then they go on. So there's paper whites, there's early cheers, there's sol d'ors, there's one called Grand Monarch as well. I have an unnamed variety which comes up and flowers in the garden.
So this is a bulb, isn't
they're
it?
They're a bulb. Mm. Now, many people think you can't grow them in southeast Queensland, but you can. It's only the daffodils that are just should be seen as annuals. This form should be seen as something you can have long term. These have been flowering for well over 10 years in my garden. They were planted when I first came in. Some were even there before I moved. The trick is to plant them a little deeper than what they recommend on the packet. So plant them about 25 centimetres below ground level when they're available. Buy them when they're fresh and plump at the beginning of the season. That's usually around February, March. Keep them in your crisper department for about 4 to 6 weeks. Then plant them deep. Now, as these plants grow, they actually bury themselves just that little bit deeper each year as well. And the other reason for planting them deeper is because when the summer comes, that depth actually protects them from the heat intensity. So that top layer of soil can get quite hot in the summertime, yet being a bit deeper protects them from that extreme temperature, so they can come up every year no matter what.
Interesting.
People should be growing these.
You have more success with growing these than I do in my garden in Wynnum because you get a colder winter. So it's the trick of having that variation in between the hotter summers and the cooler winters that gives you the cutting edge on some things.
Most probably. I have seen these growing in a lot of inner city Brisbane gardens as well. And the thing is, at the end of the flowering, that's a crucial point. So never let the flowers go into little seed pods, because all the plant does is put all its energy into producing those. So you've got to deadhead them as they go. But when they've completely finished flowering, that is the time to scatter a little bit of slow-release fertiliser around the base of the plants. So at that point, the plant will still look leafy for a couple of months afterwards, and they'll slowly die down. And as they do, they're then withdrawing all the starches and nutrients back into the bulb to produce an embryonic flower for the following season. That flower is already produced in the previous year, and the slow release fertilizer helps and assists with that.
Very knowledgeable, Noel. That's amazing.
It's pretty
basic. It's not basic if you don't know it. No, I don't know any of this. Now, boys, it's time to move on to jobs to do in the garden. It's a great time of year to get into the garden and get some work done. So what jobs would you be doing now?
Because the weather is so cold, it's really important to focus on plants that enjoy that weather. And so if you're starting from scratch and you haven't got much skill, I'd grow radishes.
Mm-hmm.
They're often overlooked. Normally we would eat them raw in salads, in which case they can be quite hot. Certain varieties can be hotter than others. And if they're grown dry, they can be hotter still. So you can actually change the temperature by the amount of water you give them.
Ah.
But one of the things that I really like is the large radishes, and some of them, there's Tondo Nero, which is a black radish that grows the size of a tennis ball, which is Italian.
Mm.
There's also common things like French breakfast, which you'd find in the shops. But the advantage of them is that if you cook them, then they taste like turnip. They lose their heat, so they become a very mild vegetable. So you can use them to make cream of radish soup.
Have you got the Tondo Nero in?
Not this year, no, not this year, because we're still finishing off the ones I had last year.
I was just thinking how great they'd look, really thinly sliced.
Oh, they're lovely. They're lovely. They're good sliced. They're good grated, cooked as well. But the way that I preserve the surplus, because you always end up with a glut, the way I do it is I pickle them with vinegar and I add garlic and ginger. And so they become a really nice little relish, and you can use those on plates with salads and meats.
So are you just dropping them into a jar with the vinegar and everything, or slicing them up?
Thinly slice them, and I put very small bits of diced garlic and ginger, and it's always to taste. I never say you must have this amount in, because people's tastes vary, but equal proportions of garlic and ginger really turn it into something rather yummy.
I bet.
And that will store in the fridge for a year, and that's what I'm still finishing.
Okay, get your radishes in. And what about you, Noel? What jobs to do?
Well, from the veggie garden into the ornamental garden.
Oh, yes.
This is a really good time for getting out and pruning some of the trees that have dropped their leaves. And a good example of that would be crepe myrtles.
Mm-hmm.
So I've just pruned a couple of my crepe myrtles, and you don't have to be, you know, too worried about how far you prune them down. So coppicing them down is quite a good thing to do. And for all those blokes out there that love pruning, I understand where you're at.
Get into it.
Absolutely. But it's a good time because the plant's denuded of leaves, which means you can see the shape of the tree and you can actually control how it grows.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes crepe myrtles have been planted in the past in very, you know, bad positions, right next to fence lines or right too close to the house. So people often don't have an alternative but to prune. But the plant responds beautifully in the spring by putting on fresh green growth, followed by lovely racemes of brightly coloured flowers from all shades of pink and magenta into lavender, all the way through summer. They are one of the best trees anyone can actually have in their gardens.
They're beautiful, aren't they?
This is also a good time for digging and dividing many perennials in the garden because the plants don't feel the move, they don't feel the structural change. So it's a good time for doing that. And this is a wonderful way of filling up spaces of the garden with plants that do exceptionally well. So some of the alstroemerias that I have in my garden, I've been doing that with. Even geraniums I've been doing that with as well. I've been taking cuttings off those. Things such as the walking iris, for instance, the Neomericas. Brilliant time for dividing those up and spreading those around. It gives the plants a really good chance for, you know, settling in over the cooler months.
Oh, yeah.
And then come spring, they just burst into flower. So
I was wondering about that. You know, if you're going to plant I was thinking of planting actually a lily peely. That's where I've got a hole in the fence, in the hedge. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering whether I should get it in now and let it settle or just put it in nearer to spring.
You may not see the top growth, but what the plant is doing is settling its roots into position. And this is a really important thing for a lot of people to know, LJ, because, you know, people often think that this is not a time to garden in the winter, but really it's the best time in Queensland to garden.
And you can work without getting exhausted.
Absolutely.
From the heat.
And the plants respond. When we wait until the weather warms up for ourselves, it's often right in the growing season, so we can disrupt, which means plants can take a slightly longer time to establish with the heat.
Right.
And they get
a
bit more extra stress, so perfect time.
Good time to get out there into the garden right now.
Absolutely.
Get things planted and cut back and get ready for the summer.
Well, this morning we're going to be joined by Andrew Fairbairn, an associate professor in archaeology, and he works at the University of Queensland. Just to sort of set the scene, Andrew was introduced to me because I'm known for growing yams.
Oh, yes.
And Andrew is researching the history of the cultivation of yams. And he needed to have some of my yams in order to do some of his work. Now, Andrew is on the line now. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for joining us today. Could you please explain to our audience how it is that you came to have a passion for yam growing?
Well, I'm what's known as an archaeobotanist, which means that I'm an archaeologist who looks at plant material, and I'm very that you find an archaeological site, and I'm very interested in the history of plant use, including, you know, all the foods that we eat and have available to us these days, and also understanding the way that people have used the landscape. Because if you're interested in plants, as any good gardener knows, what you're really looking at is it's sort of the human landscape, if you like, the places in which we live. So the interest in yams and in getting in touch with you and trying to get some from you came about through some work that I've been doing in Australia and in Papua New Guinea over the last sort of 5 or 10 years. And we have some archaeological material from some very early archaeological sites, which seems to have lumps of tuber in it. And I'm trying to work out whether they're yams or not.
Now, I remember reading that there's been a lot of yam growing and eating in Australia, but it's fairly simple with digging sticks and replanting them in areas that they would naturally grow. Is this the case? Is this the way they're grown in Papua New Guinea as well, just very simply?
No, a lot of traditional people in Australia, Aboriginal Australians, have used yams from the wild. They dig them up. They happen to grow in the bush where they live, and then they'll harvest them year after year. Up in New Guinea, the yams there are part of the gardens, basically. They've been grown, certainly over the last few hundred years. We know the historical record shows us that they've been grown in that area, and they're a really important food source. They're getting less important these days, actually, because things like sweet potato and cassava are actually sort of displacing them now because they're more productive. But they're actually a really important part of the gardens up in New Guinea. And what we're interested in Northern Australia, there's actually some evidence from Aboriginal people, from actually current practice, in fact, that people grow yams in their gardens there, and may well have done so quite far into the distant past. So we're interested in when that actually started. How long ago were people in Australia, as well as in Papua New Guinea, actually growing these yams?
So how are you going to go about tracing, getting the forensic evidence of this?
Well, this is where the fun begins, to be honest. We collect soil and we collect bits of charcoal, basically burnt leftover bits of plant material from, you know, where people have been sitting around cooking and stuff like that in around fires from archaeological sites in Australia and then Papua New Guinea. We do that through sieving the soil, basically. And what we do is we have very small fragments of charcoal, and we can use high-powered microscopes to look at the structure of those things to try and identify them. And it's a pretty tricky thing to do. As you'll know yourself, even if you've got a complete plant in front of you, it's often very difficult to tell what it is. Well, what we have is really the shape of the plant, a part, if you like, in this case, tubers, and also the cellular structure as well, which we can look at under the microscope. And it doesn't give us a lot of features to go from, but if we have a lot of material from known plants in the modern day, like from your garden, for example, we can look at those and see how they vary in their structure and in their shape, and then we can see if the ancient plant specimens match those. And that's really what I'm doing. So in my hand now, I've got one of your beautiful aerial potatoes, which it's the only one left. The other ones have been burnt and chopped up and have been put under the microscope, and we've been looking at them to see if they match the ancient specimens, would you believe?
So how long do you think it'll be before you can give us some evidence from your research and proof?
We've had some pretty promising results so far. The specimens that you sent me, the skin is actually very similar to the ancient specimens that I've got from a site, actually a very ancient site, 40, 50,000-year-old site up in Papua New Guinea. The difficulty I've got is that some of the cellular structure doesn't actually quite match at the moment. And I'm not exactly sure if I need to look at more specimens, because these funny little tubers we get, they actually vary quite a bit. As you know, if you cut a potato in half, the cells on the outside will be slightly different to the cells in the centre. And also I've got a PhD student, Anna Florin, is right now up in the Northern Territory collecting more specimens from other kinds of tubers, and she's going to be bringing them back in the next couple of weeks, and we're going to be looking at them in the lab together.
Well, it's fascinating stuff, Andrew, and I'm really looking forward to an update, and we have to leave it now, but I'm really looking forward to an update on this because I'm feeling personally involved in this now.
Well, you certainly are, and your specimens have been really, really valuable in this case, and I'm looking forward to giving you the news as soon as I have it.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for joining us, Andrew. I will keep a few more yams on the side just in case you need to do some more incinerating.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Jerry.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
Now, I mentioned earlier that I've got some I've got some fantastic citrus trees that perform like champions. And, you know, our lemons are famous around the suburb because each lemon gives you half a cup of juice. I mean, they are very well performing in the fruit, but they just look so covered in black soot. You know, both the fruit and the leaves are just coated. So, boys, you know I'm not much of a gardener, but I will get out there and do something if you tell me what to do.
Well, the easy thing, I suppose, is not to worry too much, because what you're seeing is black sooty mould, and that's actually a secondary problem, which is to do with sap-sucking insects. Uh-huh. That's actually releasing a honeydew. And now the black sooty mould won't stop the fruit from forming or change its flavour in any way, and so that's why you're still getting nice fruit, although aesthetically it may not be as pleasing to the
eye. Just give them a bit of a scrub with dishwashing detergent
fine. That's exactly right. So all you really need is a surfactant, basically something like a horticultural oil, something like eco oil.
Oh, yeah?
And that. You can spray that on the stems underneath the foliage, because that's where you'll find most of these sap-sucking insects occur. So aphids or scale or mealybug. And it's usually the first two that is the most prevalent. And you'll see ant activity on the stems. They indicate if they're present as well. So that's all you need to do.
And what about just getting the hose and giving the plant a really good wash down? Does that help?
No, it doesn't, does it, Jerry? It doesn't really
doesn't
take
of
off.
Them.
No, it doesn't. But you can dose it down with a little bit of soapy water as well. Mm. Soapy water can dislodge the black sooty mould quite easily. It doesn't always get rid of the sap-sucking insects. This is why using your horticultural oil actually suffocates them.
Okay.
And stops them from
moving. I like to attack things at the cause, so I'll do that. And probably because we're coming to the end of a huge crop of lemons, so probably time to give it a feed and and good water.
I'd wait just a little bit longer to give it a feed, possibly around about August. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Around August is a good time to give it a feed.
Awesome.
And I wouldn't water it either.
Okay.
That's actually best. During July and August, it's best to let them just dry out and rest.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Will do. Yeah. All right. Thanks for the advice. Now, have you boys got another question?
I've got a question, and this was through my website from Cheryl. And she's actually based in Victoria, and she noticed that I was growing a vegetable, leaf vegetable, called Good King Henry.
Mm.
Now, this is, it's a relative of Oisantle. It's one of those weird things. It's in the Chenopodiaceae family.
I remember you talking about Oisantle. What was that?
That's another leaf vegetable. Mm-hmm. It's a very easy thing to grow in Brisbane, all year round spinach, and it keeps sowing itself. The Good King Henry is a perennial rather than an annual. It only grows to about 15 centimetres high. And the best way to describe it is like a dwarf perennial silver beet. And it's a very old English vegetable. And that's why I grow it, because I get a bit nostalgic.
Okay.
Anyway, she wants to get hold of seed. And the only people that I know that were likely to have the seed, and they don't always have it in stock, is Phoenix Seeds, which is in Snug, Tasmania, and you can order the seed online from those. And the other one was called The Lost Seed, which is also a Tasmanian seed company, one that Peter Cundall got me into.
Well, they're actually now in New South Wales.
Okay, yeah. They've moved. Yeah, they sell seed online.
Yes, they do.
And both of them tend to specialise in cool season crops, which is when the things that we would be growing now. So they're seasonally useful even in the subtropics.
I love Good King Henry. It's such a pretty plant. The red leaf variety is so attractive to see in the garden. It grows quite tall as well. When it's in flower, it's similar to a Oisantle, as you say.
Yeah.
But also, it's a little bit like an Artemisia in the fact that it brings an amazing amount of beneficial insects to the garden as well. It's such a pretty plant to have. Even if you've never eaten it before, just grow it for the aesthetics. It's just a gorgeous thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
And then go from there. Often people just need to take a little step in that direction, and that can often encourage them to put it on their dinner plate.
Yeah.
And what about you, Noel? Have you got another question?
Well, yes, I do. Yes, I do have a question, and the question comes from Lynn, and she asks, every time her husband mows around the base of her flowering ash, which is Fraxinus griffithi, he gets an itchy rash on the back of his neck or his shoulders. And she just wanted to know whether they cause rashes and irritations. Now, I personally haven't heard of this before. I know a lot of people that grow the Fraxinus griffithi. They're a beautiful small tree, often confused as a native, but they're not actually a native at all. But they're used quite extensively as street trees. Now, I think every person is individual when it comes to sensitivity from plant material. You know, what might be sensitive for you might not be sensitive for me.
Yeah.
So it might not be the plant itself. It might actually be that it has insects similar to something like a sapsucking insect dropping honeydew on him while he's there, and he may not realise it. Or it may be the pollen off the tree or something else, but I'm not too certain. I think the best approach when it comes to things like this is to go and see a medical practitioner and get it tested out to see if he has a sensitivity to that particular species of plant.
That reminds me of when the kids were little and they got these big blisters all over them, and we went rushing off to the doctor, and she said, have they been playing in a mango tree?
Oh.
And I said, yeah, they have. She said, oh, that saps really.
It can.
It burns your skin.
It can. See, some people have a lot of sensitivity. I break out in a rash if I'm actually handling azaleas. The little tiny hairs on the azalea leaves can give me a rash up the inner parts of my arm.
Mm-hmm.
And yet other people can handle them and there's no worries whatsoever. And last night on television they were talking about the toxicity of alstromerias, for instance. And yet I have handled, as a florist, alstromerias for many, many years and did some silly things. Never a problem whatsoever. You know, it's an individual thing.
I'm just wondering whether perhaps he works up a sweat when he's doing the mowing, opens the pores, and that makes him more predisposed to irritation. But the thing with all sorts of allergies is we change as we age, and something you're not allergic to in your youth, maybe something you're sensitive to as you get older. I have a rash which I get when I handle things in the cucumber family now.
There you go.
I never had a problem with that until 2 years ago.
Okay, well, our nursery of the week this week, guys, is a great little nursery out in the Ipswich area. It's the Plants Plus store from Raceview. So we have on the line Lisa Moores, who runs the nursery along with Brad Richards. So welcome, Lisa, to the program.
Thank you very much, and good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Lisa, let's start off by letting people know exactly where you are to begin with and how long the nursery has been operating there.
Okay, well, our nursery was established over 30 years ago, but Plants Plus has been here for 12 years. And Brad Richards, who's the owner, he's been here for 6 weeks. And so we're in Wildley Street in Raceview in Ipswich.
Right. Okay, so Brad has been there for over 6 years, though, hasn't he? He's been there for a while.
He has been here for a while.
Yes.
He's a local now.
Lisa, in the nursery that you have there, I know that Brad's always tried to, you know, diversify the product range that he's had on the floor there. Can you give us a little bit of an insight as to the sort of things you're carrying at this time of the year?
Yes, it's a very exciting time of the year with lots of colour. So we have a wide range of roses, daisies, buddleias, proteas, so lots of colour for the garden, and also your annuals such as your pansies and your primulas and petunias. So there's quite a few different coloured plants to put in. Also, we have a range of fruit trees and vegetables to plant in your veggie patch. So, yeah, so a huge range.
And, of course, this is a great time for people to choose some great fruit trees for their gardens, isn't it? So you've got a big selection there. What would be your favourite, do you think? What would be the most called for fruit tree that you would find in the nursery?
Mostly your citrus. Citrus does really well in Ipswich. Copes with the frost, copes with the heat, grows fast, lots of produce from it. So I think, you know, your lemons and your oranges are probably the most popular.
Yes.
But then we have a lot of call at the moment for berries, so your strawberries and your blueberries.
Ah, yeah.
There's people in this week after those at the moment.
What's wonderful, because berries have become very popular, especially the blueberries, haven't they, for people in their backyards. Do you get people in the area? I know that Ipswich can be rather cold. Are there people out there that are looking for a few of the poms, such as apples and pears, some of the low-chill cultivars?
They are, but it's our humidity in the summertime that tends to wipe them out. So, and coping with fruit fly seems to turn everybody off. So as much as we'd love to grow your pears and your apples, I think we're just too hot in the summer and we don't have a lot of success.
Yeah, well, I suppose picking the right cultivars is good, and really controlling the fruit fly outbreak is a very important thing, isn't it? Of course. In the way of vegetables, what sort of veggies are you finding people are looking for these days?
Well, we've had a big call for kale, so it's a nutrient superfood. So we've got lots of kale on board and all your leafy greens. But then your collies and your broccolis, very popular, and your beans and peas at the moment. So, yeah, it keeps everyone busy.
Absolutely. Now, ornamentally speaking, I mean, this is a really great time for Brisbane gardens to show a little bit of extra pizzazz, because there's lots of brightly coloured things happening all over the place. What do you have at the moment that, you know, people would go, yes, I must have that in my garden?
Oh, Roses. Everyone's in for roses at the moment, especially the Gallipoli rose.
Ah.
That's very popular. Abracadabra and candy stripe are also quite popular at the moment. But also we've got some beautiful buddleias, lavenders, polygalas, lots of geraniums flowering. A sea of colour out there.
So you've got some nice seasonal things in there. Now, the number for the nursery is 3281 3742. Lisa, it's been a pleasure chatting with you this morning. Thank you so much. The address again for Plants Plus at Ipswich or Raceview is 71 Wildey Street, Raceview in Queensland. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Bye, Lisa.
Well, it's been a great Queensland Gardening Hour podcast. We should let people know where they can find us and how to send questions so that you boys can answer them. Just go online to Queensland Gardening Hour and check out our website. We've also got a Queensland Gardening Hour Facebook page where you can comment and leave messages for Noel and Jerry. And please do. We'd love to hear your questions so that we can answer them and have a chat about gardening in the subtropics.
And we're going to be at the Queensland Garden Expo next weekend. So come up to us at Nambour and maybe we'll have a chance to take some questions right there live. And there's actually a school garden that I want to pop into. Bly Public School was burnt down not so long ago and they lost their garden. The kids have rebuilt the garden and they're going to be there at the expo. So I'm hoping to have a chat with them and give them something to plant.
Lovely. It's always a wonderful event. It's Queensland's premier event,
isn't it,
for gardening. And we're all there, you know, the whole lot of us. So anyone who can come up and find us and ask us questions, and it'll be a lot of fun.
All right. Well, thanks so much for listening and we'll see you on the next Queensland Gardening Hour podcast.
Bye for now.